This is KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara, and this is the Kenai Conversation. On today's episode of the Kenai Conversation, we're talking to Lisa Parker, who was recently inducted into the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame. Thank you, Lisa, so much for being here.
Thank you, Ashlyn, for having me.
All right. So to start, I'm going to go ahead and read part of your bio from the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame, just to kind of, you know, lay the groundwork for what we'll be talking about today. So a fourth generation Alaskan, Lisa Parker has over 50 years of public service and involvement in local government, resource development, and conservation policy. Her exceptional career supporting Alaskan communities and people began as she graduated from high school early so she could work as a page for the Alaska State Senate. At the age of 19, she won her first election as one of 11 members of the Anchorage Charter Commission, and in college she was awarded the National Harry S. Truman Scholarship for Alaska for academic excellence and public service. So, you know, I'd like to start, you know, the very first words there, a fourth generation Alaskan. Tell me a little bit about, you know, your family growing up in Alaska, how your family came to be here.
Okay, thanks. So my family came to be here was first my great-grandfather went to the Nome area in the late 1880s, early 1890s, and was there and went there to do construction, was then a gold miner.
Okay.
Left, and then my grandfather was in Alaska, and he was in the timber industry, but he was a camp cook. He was the chef.
Okay.
And a good cook. And as a side note, my husband has his bib because my grandmother always said, your husband is such a good cook. He's the only one in the family that deserves to have this apron. My dad ended up coming, had a choice. He could go to China or he could come to Alaska after World War II. And he decided he was going to follow in his father and grandfather's footsteps and come to Alaska.
Okay.
And so he was in Fairbanks in the 1940s. And then we moved out to a place called Lake Minchumina, which is on the north side of Mount McKinley, Denali. And it was while we were there that Mom, when she had to deliver babies, would fly into Fairbanks. Kids would be born. And then we would fly back home. So I started flying at the age of 4 days old and
oh
have been flying ever since.
And so your great-grandfather, you said he worked construction in Nome. I guess, did he dabble in the gold rush at all?
He dabbled in the gold rush, and my dad had his gold poke bag from there. Unfortunately, a fire at our house, all that stuff got burned up. But yeah, he dabbled in gold, and he made money. Mm-hmm. He then went back to Spokane area and up into Canada and was involved in the oil industry in Canada, and all the money he made in the gold rush, he spent in the oil fields in Canada and
okay.
Blew it all.
Yeah.
didn't come away a wealthy man.
Okay.
But experienced.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you mentioned your dad kind of having the option of, you know, going, you said China or Alaska. Mm-hmm. I guess why Alaska? Why? What is it about this, you know, part of the world that you think draws your family to it?
Alaska provides you with opportunity. You have the opportunity here to do things that you can't do in other places in the world. It is the opportunity to explore, the opportunity to make a difference. And if you want to do that, you can do that here. And you're not going to be held back if you have the desire in your heart to do that. And like I said, Dad wanted to follow in his dad's and his grandfather's footsteps. And he had heard about it from them. And so he was like, I'm going to follow their dream. And he convinced my mom, who he married her. She was 15 when they got married. And she ended up, while dad was up here getting the house settled, my mom gave birth to their first child.
Okay.
And so my sister and my mom, and my mom had just turned 17 and my sister was 6 months old, in April of 1947 landed in Fairbanks.
Oh my gosh.
My mom, being a girl from San Francisco, thought she told her mom, I'll be back in 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
It took her 6 years before she went back to San Francisco.
Oh my gosh. Is that a testament to her liking Alaska, or was it just logistically difficult to get out of the state, or?
It was a testament to her liking it.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was definitely spirited and determined. So she wasn't going to let something hold her back.
Mm-hmm. That, I mean, I can't imagine relocating as like a 17-year-old with a child to Fairbanks.
Fairbanks in 1947, and Fairbanks in April of 1947. You know, the runway is all muddy. You know what it's like at breakup.
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about it. They didn't have a paved runway at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom gets off the plane in a dress and a hat and gloves with her baby. And she was kind of in shock at first, but she stuck around. And when I told you about the gold poke bag burning up in the fire, I told my mom, I said, because she had severe rheumatoid arthritis and couldn't get around real well, I said, you have the opportunity now to go anywhere, and you can go someplace where it's not cold, don't have to deal with the ice and the snow. And she said, after all these years in Alaska, why would I go anywhere else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm the same way. After 70 plus years in Alaska, why am I going to go anywhere else where this state has afforded me the opportunity to do things that are amazing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, tell me about growing up in rural Alaska. What was your family life like?
Well, you know, it's interesting. And I compare today to what it was like in the 50s and early 60s and even the 40s for my parents, where you ordered everything through the catalog and things were mailed to you because you weren't going to the grocery store to buy things.
Mm-hmm.
Today, what are we doing? We're not only getting food and clothes, medicines, these are coming through the mail. And that's what we used to do 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like we're reverting. So in another 20 years, are we going to go back to brick and mortar stores?
Mm-hmm. Does that like the cyclical nature?
The cyclical nature. Mm-hmm. And like they say, you know, price of oil does the same thing. It has that cyclical nature. Mm-hmm. And so are we doing that same thing with how we're purchasing goods and services today?
Mm-hmm.
But I was 2.5 when we moved from Minchimina to Anchorage. And because we'd been living out in rural Alaska, where we lived in Anchorage was way out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great place to grow up because we had woods all around and places to go play. And, you know, after getting chores done, if I wanted to go fishing, I could walk over to Campbell Creek and go fishing at Campbell Creek, or down the hill from where we lived was Chester Creek, and places to go fishing and just go hang out.
Mm-hmm. Why did your family relocate to Anchorage?
One, my dad was with the Federal Aviation Administration, and they realized with a growing family that they needed to go someplace where it was going to be easier for the kids to go to school. My mom taught my sister and my oldest brother Calvert School.
Okay.
So she homeschooled them out at Minchimina. But then when we moved to Anchorage, we started in the public school system.
Okay. You mentioned a sister and a brother. How many siblings do you have?
There were five kids, a sister, three brothers, and myself.
Where do you fall in that lineup?
I am the baby.
Okay. All right.
I'm the youngest.
Okay. Do you feel like you know, you maybe fall into some of those, like, you know, youngest child archetypes? Or I'm asking this as an oldest child.
I fall in that, you know, I was the one that always made sure things got done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always like, okay, Lisa will take care of that. So I would take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the bossy one. The older ones were the bossy ones. And yeah. I see that in friends of mine who, and other relatives that are the oldest, where the oldest is more bossy than us younger ones. We're more willing to get along, do whatever needs to be done in order for things to keep going and be kind of be happy, so you don't have a lot of yelling and getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm. I guess did anybody else in your family ever dabble in like public service, or where did that, how did you develop an interest in you know, public service?
Well, my parents were involved, and they helped set up and were involved with Alaska Conservation Society. And I remember going to meetings out at, now is Alaska Pacific University, used to be Alaska Methodist University. And so they were involved in those things and in the parks and trails. But at the age of about 12, I started babysitting.
Okay.
in my neighborhood. And one of the families I babysat, he was a state legislator.
Oh, who was this?
His name was Gene Guess.
Okay.
And Gene was a legislator, went on to become Speaker of the House. His daughter, Gretchen, was also in the legislature and served in the State House and State Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But it was through the Guesses that I kind of first started dabbling in politics. And Gene, when he would be running for re-election to the State House, you would take and you would get mailing labels from Motsnik.
Mm.
And so what we would sit and do at the table is we would sit and we would go through the labels, because you didn't want to send multiple flyers to the same house.
Sure.
Because of the cost.
Yeah.
And so we would go through and we would look and we would come across the O'Hares. And looking and I'd see O'Hare, and then you look at the address.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, there's Ashland. Oh, but there's another one at the same address. So you would handwrite their name onto the label and you'd pull those off.
Okay.
So you weren't sending.
Yeah.
And so it was through Gene and Carolyn that I first started getting involved. My dad in the early 70s was on the borough assembly.
Okay.
And
this was in Anchorage?
This was in Anchorage, yeah, the Greater Anchorage Area Borough Assembly. He served on that. And then it was in 74, after Jay Hammond was elected governor, Hammond reached out and asked my father if he would be commissioner of highways.
Oh, interesting.
And so he became commissioner of highways in the Hammond administration. And it was that next year in 75 when we had the vote on whether or not a charter commission should be formed to unify the Greater Anchorage Area Borough and the city of Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked my dad, what does this charter commission do? And he said, well, if you want to learn about local government and what goes on in local government, this is where you would learn.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so to put your name on the ballot, you had to get signatures from 50 people, and I don't know if there was a filing fee or not, but mm-hmm. So I got the signatures and...
Oh, you ran for the charter.
I ran for the charter commission.
Okay.
There were...
How old were you at this time?
19.
Okay.
19. So there were three seats at large, four seats from the city of Anchorage and four seats from the Greater Anchorage Area Borough.
Okay.
And I ran from the borough because that's where I lived. And there were 10 of us running for those four seats.
Okay.
And there were people who were smarter than me, knew everything about what to do and how it should be done.
Was there anybody younger than you who, or like, were you the youngest person running?
I was the youngest person.
Okay.
And what I said when I campaigned then is still something I subscribe to today. And when I would be asked the question, well, what do you think about such and such? And I said, you know, I don't know, but I will work hard and I will listen.
Mm-hmm.
And still today, I work hard and I listen and I care about what the public thinks and what the public has to say.
Mm.
You know, and there's many times on issues that come now to city council that personally, if I had to personally vote, I might not vote for something.
Mm.
But because the public that is impacted by this has reached out and offered their opinions on what they think we should do as a city, I listen to that.
Mm.
And there are times I vote because that's what's best for the public at large.
Mm-hmm. That it's interesting that you say that because we're obviously coming off of municipal election season, and I always think that's a really interesting question to ask candidates. Do you, you know, when you're presented with a situation, you know, do you do what you think is best, or do you do what your constituents want? And I feel like you get a lot of, you know, there's a lot of differences of opinions on that. You know, you've got some people who say, well, the people elected me to this position, so they trust me to make the right decision. But I think there's just as many people who are saying exactly what you're saying, right? Which is, you know, if my constituents want me to do this, then that's what I'm obligated to do.
Right. And there's issues that pop up during the course of your term that you're not expecting,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so you're not always going to maybe have a position
mm-hmm.
or, like I said, you've got a position and you think it should be this way, but the overall public thinks that there needs to be change.
Mm-hmm.
And change is hard, but change can also be good.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm wondering, like, what was the political landscape like when you were elected to the charter? I guess first I'm thinking, when you're working with the Guesses on their legislative campaign, do you remember what some of the, like, what were the issues that they were running on or that he was running on in that time? Was there one that stood out?
You know, I don't remember.
Okay. Well, then how about like your time on the charter? Like, what was coming across your desk? Is there anything you remember as being particularly maybe impactful or?
So interesting. Jane Anvik and I just wrote a piece, and, you know, we talked about some of the main areas where we did, where there was differences of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And in Anchorage, the city of Anchorage had a weak mayor and the borough had a strong mayor.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're writing the charter, there was a split as to whether or not we should go with the weak mayor or the strong mayor.
And it might be helpful, when you're saying weak and strong, you're not talking about like personality traits, right? You're talking about like the authorities that they have.
The authorities.
Okay.
And so a weak mayor is more like a ceremonial. They don't have a vote. They do proclamations, kind of like the city of Soldotna. We have a ceremonial mayor, and the mayor only votes in the case of a tie.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not voting on issues regularly.
Mm-hmm.
The strong mayor, in the case of the Greater Anchorage Area Borough, all the powers, kind of like the governor, the powers are vested in the mayor to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we ended up doing with the charter is we decided, and with the ceremonial mayor, it's a manager form of government.
Mm-hmm.
The city manager runs the government. So what we decided to do in the charter was, we put into the charter that it would be strong mayor with the veto powers, but the mayor also had to hire a city manager.
Okay.
So we kind of married the two.
Mm-hmm. What are the, I guess, like the pros and cons of each?
I think it comes down when you're a larger entity, having a strong mayor that has more authority, it's easier to, particularly in an emergency, get things done.
Mm.
You also know that the buck stops kind of with the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm wondering, like, you're 19 at this time. Did you want to, like, study? Did you know you wanted to go into or focus on politics, government when you went to college?
I did, but I also waited. I didn't graduate from high school and go right to college.
Okay.
When I graduated from high school, when you read in the intro, I went down to work in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
And work for the legislature. And that was back in the day when the legislature didn't have staff.
Okay.
There were the pages in the House and the Senate, you know, that took care of putting the bills in their notebooks and distributing stuff for the senators or the legislators, but they didn't have staff. And so in order to get the job, the person that I was talking to, Senator Lowell Thomas Jr., he said, well, if you want to be in Juneau and get this job, if you want to get this job, you need to be in Juneau.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I talked to my parents and they were fine with me pursuing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to my principal and he said, well, if the teachers are okay with it and you want to leave school early because it was before the end of the semester,
okay,
go ahead. And so I did, and I went down and I was able to get the job.
And this is before the Anchorage Charter Commission?
This was before the Anchorage Charter Commission, yeah.
Okay.
So this was like, I was 17 when I went down to mm-hmm. Juneau.
I guess how did you end up deciding that you wanted to be a Senate page? That just is like such a specific role. I'm wondering, like, did you know other people who were doing that, or how did it end up on your radar?
You know, I don't know if it was something because I was babysitting for Representative Guest.
Sure.
That he said, this would be a good opportunity for you to go do that. But I did, and I ended up, so I was in Juneau for that year and then came back, and it was that summer that I ended up, I was working for Alaska Public Interest Research Group.
What is that?
It is the ACPIRG is a nonprofit that kind of looks at issues and policies and is looking out for the public interest.
Hmm.
It's more focused on public interest, not the corporate interest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a high paying job of $250 a month.
Oh God. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
well, I guess going back to when you're still in Juneau, I'm wondering, you know, what was it like in the Capitol building at that time? Like what were you learning down there?
I ended up learning a lot because legislators didn't have staff.
Right.
And I became friends with a lot of them. And I said, you know, if you ever need help on doing research or anything, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would reach, sometimes some of them did reach out and ask me to help them do research on some things. And don't ask me what it was.
Okay.
Because I don't remember, but I remember my friend from UniCleat, Chuck Degnan, him reaching out and asking. And so anytime, you know, you get that opportunity to help,
mm-hmm.
And expand your knowledge and expand your base, it's a good opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Was the I guess how did the legislature function at that time? Did it seem like they were able to get a lot of things done? Was there a lot of gridlock? What was your impression of that?
So this was back in the day when people really got along.
Okay.
While they may have disagreed on issues, for the most part, things were getting done.
Mm-hmm.
It was much different composition then, and there were more Democratic legislators than Republican legislators at that point in time.
Mm.
And then the shift kind of came in the 80s, where the focus went more to where it was more Republican than Democratic. But people worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity in the mid-70s to work for Representative Cooper from Fairbanks, who went on to become governor. And then in the late 70s, early 80s, I worked for Representative Cotton from Eagle River. And the difference between when I worked as a page and the early 80s, dramatic difference.
Mm.
And part of the reason for that difference, we started to get money from the pipeline.
Right, yeah.
And the money had such a dramatic impact, and still today has a dramatic impact on how decisions are made.
And that's just because there was like tons of money to go around, or I guess how did you see that manifest in the building?
Well, there was, back in that point in time, there was a lot of money. And the House, the Senate, and the governor had made a decision that they would basically go one third, one third, one third.
Mm-hmm.
So the House members could decide how they wanted to spend their one third, Senate could decide how they wanted to spend their one third, and the governor could decide how they wanted to spend his one third for capital projects.
Okay.
And
that seems like a tidy division.
they were like, okay, this is how you guys want to do it. Fine.
Yeah.
We're not gonna squabble because that's how you decided you wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked until the money started to dry up.
Mm-hmm.
And I, going back, it was probably in the mid-90s, maybe. I'd have to go back and double check to where that one-third, one-third, one-third dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided not to do it anymore. But, you know, these days we don't have much capital money for projects, so it's not something that you can bring back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we did see was, because there was so much money in the early 80s, the number of projects that came in. And when I was working for Sam Cotton, he was, at that point in time, he was finance chair in the House. And
it's a good role to have.
it was, until there was the coup, and they were kicked out. But the number, we had like $4 billion of excess money to spend.
Mm, that's hard to imagine right now.
We had $6 billion in requests. So the people just kept coming up with these ideas and things that they wanted to do. You know, and the grain terminals in Valdez are still there that were built, but never used.
Mm-hmm.
Seward wanted to build grain terminals too. Why do you need two sets of grain terminals? One in Seward and one in Valdez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe it sounds like maybe the there being a lot of money to go around funded some projects that maybe didn't age well.
They didn't age well, or they were constructed and never used.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it would have been, could we have spent the money wiser? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's kind of like when you win the lottery and all this, you get all this money, right? You're like, whoo, let's go have fun.
Yeah.
And it was a lottery back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, you know, you and I are having this conversation in 2025, and I'm wondering now with the benefit of hindsight, you know, if you had a magic wand at that time and could, you know, make decisions then knowing what you know now, is there, where, I guess, how would you have spent or not spent that influx of money?
I know there were times where myself and some other staff were making recommendations to our bosses mm-hmm. that they shouldn't fund projects, but because of the pressure coming from other legislators, they went ahead and funded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were looking at it from a staff standpoint of, you know, does this make sense? Is this the best way to spend the money?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're an elected person, you're looking at it from the standpoint of, are my constituents going to be happy that I funded this project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like the grain, that's probably a good example of a project like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, I mean, we focused a bit on Juneau. How did you end up on the Kenai Peninsula?
So I ended up here back in the early 90s. I was working for a company called Kamenko, Alaska. It's now known as Tech Alaska.
Okay.
And we developed the Red Dog Mine.
Oh, interesting.
And so I was commuting all the time from Anchorage to up to Red Dog. I was going to Fairbanks for meetings, Seattle, Washington, D.C. I was on the road all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I had a small son at home. And it got to the point where it was impacting my son.
Yeah.
He'd be like, okay, Mom, what's your schedule? How long are you here for?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I would go to leave, he's grabbing me around my knees and crying. And, Mom, you can't go. You can't go.
Yeah.
So I saw that. And a friend of mine told me about this job they had seen posted for here in the Kenai Peninsula. At Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council.
Okay.
And they were looking to hire their first executive director.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was like a fledgling organization at that point? Like it was just getting off the ground? Or
yep. Okay. Just getting off the ground. It was created under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. There was the Cook Inlet and the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Councils established by the Oil Pollution Act.
Mm-hmm.
And so I submitted my application. And I called a friend of mine that lived here and asked him about it. Turns out this was a family friend. He and my dad worked together at FAA. Well, it turns out my friend said, well, you know, I'm thinking about applying too. And said, okay. Well, anyway, I submitted my application and ended up that I got selected as one of like 10 finalists.
Okay.
For the executive director job. 10. Mm-hmm. Not one or two.
Yeah, that's still a pretty crowded field.
It was a very crowded field. And then I look at the people that were on the list and I'm like, okay, there's no chance.
Mm-hmm.
So I came down and I did the interview with the RCAC board of directors. They were the ones that were interviewing, and they decided they were going to vote that day.
Mm.
And so they voted. And so they took, and after the first round, the people who didn't get any votes were, you know, taken off, and then they voted again.
Mm-hmm.
So then it came down, there were two of us, and I was surprised to be one of the two, but the other person that was the finalist was my friend who I had called on the phone to ask about it.
Oh my gosh.
His name and longtime residents of the area will remember Jim and Sue Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And Sue just recently moved away, but it was Jim Carter and I that were the finalists for the job. And in the end, they selected me. And so we moved down here in May of 91.
What was it about, like the Citizens Advisory, like what was it about this organization that made you want to be a part of it?
It was something new. Mm-hmm. You were establishing and creating something that had just been enacted into law. So, you know, there were the board of directors, but they didn't know where they were going to go, what they were going to do. So you're putting in place the groundwork, the framework for this organization. Mm-hmm. And it's like the logo that they have today is the logo that we developed 35 years ago,
mm-hmm.
34, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those things. And, you know, you're setting up policies and procedures. You're creating something new. It's kind of like what we did with the charter in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
You're creating a new government. Well, we're creating a new organization that's going to help oversee oil operations in Cook Inlet to make sure that oil operations are safe and that we're protecting our environment.
Mm-hmm. What did the early days of that look like? What were you doing as executive director?
Oh, the early days were tough because the way the organization was set up, and as I don't have the details if it's still set up similar today, but we're funded by the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what we wanted for money and what they wanted to provide us for money, there was a difference of opinion.
Seems like there might be some inherent clashes there.
there were some clashes. And there was at one point, it looked like the Citizens Advisory Council was going to dissolve and it wasn't going to make it because the industry didn't want to fund it to what we wanted to fund it to.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember saying to my son, I said, you know, I may be out of a job soon,
mm-hmm.
and we might not be living here anymore. And his response is, I don't care, but whatever you do, don't go back to Red Dog.
Mm. Why did he have such strong opinions about because of the travel?
Because he didn't see me.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He liked having me around. Which is kind of nice that your kid wants to have you around.
Yeah. You know, we kind of jumped over something there. You mentioned, you know, your husband and your son. How did you meet your husband?
Oh,
who KDLL listeners may know as, you know, DJ Steve Horn.
DJ Steve Horn, Blues Cafe. So Steve and I first met in 73. He was working for Attorney General Havelock, and he was an intern that had been set up. And my brother was also an intern. My brother was in the governor's office. And so we met back in 73. Well, I'm Doug's little sister. You know, don't want to pay any attention, but over the years we stayed in touch, and 45 years later we're still together. Mm-hmm. So we've just celebrated our 45th wedding anniversary.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
did the two of you like have parallel careers in government at all?
No.
Okay.
No, Steve, after leaving Juno, he ended up working in for a company, Urethane Specialties.
Okay.
And so he was more on the business side. I was on the government side and then did consulting. But no, other than when we've been doing consulting work together, our paths have not been parallel, but they've complemented each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you have a son. Tell me about your son.
My son is an amazing guy. Currently lives in Louisville, Kentucky, with his wife and our grandson, who is 9 years old and is a big Dodgers fan.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, the fellow who's the catcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers went to the school in Louisville that my grandson is going to now.
Okay. All right.
And so
that through line is a little clearer now.
Yeah. So, in fact, he dressed up for the school Halloween party, and he dressed up as a Will Smith.
Okay.
Guy.
Kentucky is not close to Alaska. Did you ever leave the state and live in Kentucky, or how did your son land in Kentucky?
He landed in Kentucky through our friend Denny Crum.
Okay.
So back in the day when Kenai River Sportfish was bringing folks up for the Kenai River Classic, they were having people be housed in homes of people in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so Steve and I said, yeah, we'd house somebody. And so I went to my friend who was putting together the housing arrangements and looked at the list, and I saw this guy, Denny Crum, who was basketball coach for the University of Louisville Cardinals. And he and I shared the same birthday, March 2nd.
Okay.
And I said, well, if it's okay, we would host Denny. And so we ended up having Denny in our home. And so Denny invited us back to Louisville that January to come to basketball games. And we stayed at the Crum's house. And
okay.
So one of the things that Denny showed us while we were there that he was very proud of was this golf course mm-hmm. called Valhalla.
Oh, okay.
And
the Nordic heaven or the Viking heaven, or
it's a beautiful golf course.
Yeah, okay.
And he was proud of it. And so a couple years later, my son decided that he wanted to pursue a degree in golf management.
Mm.
And when he was applying to colleges, he only applied to colleges that were offering this degree in professional golf management.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up going to Florida State the first year. And as part of this degree, you have to do internships at golf courses.
Okay.
And so my son, Nick, reached out to Denny and said, can you introduce me to the golf pro at Valhalla? I'd like to submit a resume and see about doing internship there. And Denny did. And Keith, who's still there, still there today, hired Nick to do his first internship there in Louisville.
Okay.
And while he was there, Nick ended up staying with Denny and Susan at the house. And
been there ever since?
And he ended up going to Pinehurst in North Carolina the next year. And then he went to Winged Foot outside New York City the next year. And then he had to do a long internship, and he went back to Valhalla. And okay. It was in 2000, since 2008, he's been full-time resident of Louisville. And that's where he met his wife, who's from Delaware.
Mm-hmm. Have there, did you and Steve ever think about like moving down there to be closer to them? Or do you think they'll ever move up here?
I can tell you they will never move up here.
Okay.
We have talked about potentially doing that, but it's hard on the heart.
Yeah.
Because for me, I am so in love with my community and my state. If I relocated to Louisville, what would I do?
Right.
And the fellow who was the chair of the Charter Commission back in 1975, his name was Frank Reed. And Frank was a banker, great, great fellow. And I once, this was like 25th reunion for the Charter, and Frank picked me up at the airport. And I asked him about how his kids were and where his kids and his grandkids were. And they lived out of state.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Frank, I said, so have you and Maxine ever thought about going and living there? And he said, No, because my friends are here.
Yeah.
And if I went there, I wouldn't have my friends.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, you know, community here on the Central Peninsula, where we were talking about CIRCAC, and that's not the only role that you have held here on the Central Peninsula. I mean, you spent some time at the borough. You know, talk about some of the other, you know, your community here on the Central Peninsula.
So, yeah, I was, after leaving Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council a couple of years later, planning director was retiring, and Don Gilman was looking for a planning director and encouraged me to apply. And the first go around, I didn't apply, but then it came open again a couple months later, and I applied. So I spent 5 years there at the borough working for with both Don Gilman and Mike Navarre. And then I also, it's interesting, I spent many years working out at Agrium at the fertilizer facility. And I was at the airport and I was talking to this gentleman, and his name was Mike Nugent. He was the plant manager at the time out at the plant at Agrium. And at that time, it was still, oh, I don't remember what Unical called it back in that at that time, but Unical was looking to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And Agrium was looking to buy. And Agrium before had been Cominco Fertilizers. Cominco Fertilizers and Cominco Alaska were related.
Mm-hmm.
And so people that were familiar in Cominco Fertilizers remembered me from the work I did with Red Dog. So they said to Mike, this lady, Lisa Parker, when she left Red Dog, I think she moved down to the Kenai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see if she's still around? We need her. We need her help.
Mm-hmm.
And they found me and reached out, and I ended up first doing some contract work for them and then went to work as a full-time employee until we unfortunately had to shut the facility down.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Agrium, I ended up doing some work with Apache that bought a lot of leases back in the early 2011, I think, is when we bought a whole bunch of leases in Cook Inlet.
Okay.
And we did a lot of seismic work. And we're hoping to be able to drill for oil and gas, but then things changed and Apache decided to pull out of Alaska. They wanted me to move at that time. They wanted me to move to Denver.
Mm.
And I couldn't do it. I'm embedded here in the Kenai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. Your employment history, I feel like, is so diverse. There's not like, you know, there's a lot of different industries there. And I mean, sticking with, you know, kind of oil and gas for a moment, or, you know, I'm wondering, there are so many different things happening with oil and gas right now on the peninsula. And of course, the big one that comes to mind is this proposed LNG project. And I'm wondering kind of where you stand or what your thoughts, outlook are on that sector of our local economy right now.
We're at an interesting crossroads, but it's kind of the same crossroads Agrium was at back when we were trying to get enough gas to keep the plant operational.
Mm-hmm.
So these days it seems like companies keep enough gas available and online, and as they see the need for more to come, they'll go out and they'll do more exploration, bring more facilities online.
Mm-hmm.
We are at a point where can we continue to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Some say they think there's still sufficient gas in Cook Inlet to be found to bring online. Others say because of where it is, it's too expensive, can't do it. You know, we've got three competing proposals right now. for, we've got Anstar that's going to maybe import. We've got Chugach and Harvest that have teamed up to import. And then we have Glenfarne that is looking to build a pipeline initially to Mat-Su to connect into the system.
Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting to see which one comes in first.
Mm-hmm. Is there one you think at this point in time you think maybe has a better outlook than the others?
Well, I have to say, since I worked for Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation in the past.
I didn't know that.
I probably, you know, and that is who Glenfarne is working with now.
Mm-hmm.
I know they have the permits, the major permits. There's still some that they need to get, and they need other things they need to do. They probably have the edge, but I don't know in terms of how far along Harvest and Chugach are with moving forward with the previous LNG plant,
mm-hmm.
and what NSTAR's plans are as well. And I think NSTAR is also working with Glenfarne.
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes down to who's got the permits and who has the money.
Yeah.
And which one's going to pencil out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know enough about the other two.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that, you know, the pipeline and the infrastructure for putting the LNG plant in Nikiski is expensive.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be the overarching concern, right? Like the conservative estimate of $44 billion. You know, where do you get that?
Yeah. And, you know, I just hope for the residents of the rail belt from Fairbanks down that we get some better clarity, whether it's one of those three projects.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Hillcorp and Fury find more gas. You know, Fury was very successful this summer,
mm-hmm.
in bringing more gas and doubling their production out on their platform. And I see where Hillcorp is also busy drilling more.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, you know, an elected official right now, what do you think needs to happen to provide that security to rail belt customers that you're talking about? Is it just kind of step back and let everybody do their thing, or is there room for more intervention by, you know, state leaders?
I think the conversation needs to stay active, because I don't know that there's incentives that can be offered. We've had those in the past that created some concern.
You're talking about for new drilling in the inlet?
Right. You know, mm-hmm. and do you offer, you know, incentives where for every dollar that you spend, I'm going to give you 10 cents back? I think the pressure needs to come is that the public wants more certainty that they're not going to be in a blackout situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was back in the day we had, and I think they're restarting the campaign potentially for red, yellow, green lights.
Mm-hmm.
Green lights, gas supply is fine. Yellow light is you need to be cautious, not use as much electricity, turn your heat down. And red light is we're in a catastrophic situation.
Mm-hmm. If you had to assign a stoplight color right now, where do you think we're at?
I think right now we're still green.
Okay. That's more optimistic than I thought you were going to be.
Yeah. But we're also at the beginning of winter.
Right.
So depends on temperatures, demand. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, we're at the beginning of winter where things are getting colder and the days are getting shorter. So we're using more electricity. Mm-hmm. There's more demand now. So, you know, a month from now, we could be in the yellow.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've been talking for about an hour now. And what we haven't even addressed is your role on as vice mayor of Soldotna, which is how I know you first and foremost. And I guess I'd be interested to hear, you know, given everything that we've already talked about, your extensive experience in government and just all of these different areas, you know, how does all of that inform your role on the city council right now?
I have to say, from a city council standpoint, I think Soldotna is, I've always called Soldotna one of Alaska's best kept secrets.
Mm.
It's a great community. And between council and the city administration that we've had over the years, everybody works together. We don't always agree. But at the end, we don't hold it against the other person that they didn't vote for something I wanted them to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
We move on because we know that in order to move forward, we have to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And we can agree to disagree, and let's move on to the next subject.
Mm-hmm.
I've been honored that Mayor Whitney has asked me to serve as vice mayor when he's not able to. And I think it's based on the experience that I've had over the years, but also my ability to work with people. And that I'm not going to be that confrontational, in-your-face person.
Mm-hmm.
Let's sit down and chat and talk about things and see if we can come up with a compromise situation on issues. So,
mm-hmm. Well, and I'm also just thinking about the things that we haven't addressed yet, right? Which is, you know, I'm thinking of Alaska Municipal League and the Board of Regents for the University of Alaska and just all of these, you know, we could talk for hours, I think, about your extensive, you know, experience in public service. But I'm wondering, you know, because our time is slightly compressed, when you think about, you know, Alaska in the next 5 to 10 years, you know, what do you view as some of the state's biggest challenges? And then I guess as a second part of that, what do you think needs to happen to, you know, keep the state moving forward? That's a very large question, but you've got a diverse background.
Yeah. Well, so unfortunately, I don't see people wanting to work together.
Mm.
And it'll be interesting come August to see, of all the candidates that we have for governor, how that shakes out. But we have to figure out a way to go move forward. Right now, what is Alaska's future? Do we have a future? And right now, I don't necessarily see one.
Mm.
Everybody's hung up on the permanent fund and the dividend that gets paid. And, you know, we need to keep the percent of market value approach there. And that was something that I worked on also back when we had the Conference of Alaskans in 2004. So
I think you just need to write a book. That sounds like would be helpful.
Yeah. But so I don't see a path for us. I see people not working together.
Mm.
I would like it if people were better thinking about, you know, besides oil and gas, what else are we going to do to grow our state? What are we going to do to keep people as residents? or to encourage people to come and relocate here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a dwindling school population. I would like to see that school population grow, because I would like to see that population grow so we have a future in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're having money issues. We shouldn't be having money issues when you have $86 billion in an account. We shouldn't be having those money issues.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like that is maybe kind of a grim outlook is the word I'm going to use. But I guess, like, if you're, you know, right now you're on the city council, do you have any aspirations for like a higher political office? Or, you know, if you were in, you know, say you were made governor tomorrow, you know, what needs to happen to put Alaska on the right track in your mind?
So, you know, I'm 70 years old, so running for higher office isn't something that I'm planning to do. I'm planning to stay where I'm at. The things that we can do in Soldotna, as long as we can continue to have a strong community here and keep the Central Peninsula strong, maybe we can serve as a model for other places around Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
But no, other aspirations, no. Mm-hmm. I like what I'm doing with the city council. I'm on the Alaska Humanities Forum board. Next week, I will start on the Alaska Community Foundation board.
Okay.
So I have things to keep me busy, keep me going. We have wonderful elected officials here on the Central Peninsula right now, and I don't want to run for higher office.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, you know, circling back, you know, we give you a magic wand, right? Like, what would you change right now to, I guess, fix some of the problems that you've identified?
Oh, if I had a magic wand, I would make sure that we had good jobs.
Mm-hmm.
For here, so that we would continue to bring in families, so we would have kids, and we would have a strong educational system. If we can have a strong workforce, strong school system, I can see that that is the part of the foundations for strong communities.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a magic wand, I would make everybody say, yes, we can get along even though we disagree on issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if we circle back to the very beginning of this conversation, which was precipitated by your induction into the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame, I guess I'm wondering, you know, what has that meant to you? You know, it seems like, at least for me, it's certainly a time of reflection on your storied career in Alaska. But I mean, I'm wondering what's going through your mind as you are inducted with this into this group.
Well, first of all, I have to thank my friend Judy Brady and Pitta Benz and Cindy Roberts. Judy and reached out and asked me if I was in the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame, and I said no, and she said, you need to be. And it was Judy and Pitta working with Cindy that pulled together my nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you get nominated, then are you going to get selected? And I was like, yeah, I probably won't get selected. That's okay. I know,
but you were.
But I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you're selected, then you have to write a short bio,
mm-hmm.
300 words. And
we've certainly gone over 300 words.
You are a writer. You do writing. You know, it was hard. And
yeah.
Then to write the extended, it wasn't like it was a one and done for the short bio and the extended bio. It was like 10 drafts.
Yeah.
And finally, at some point, you have to go, okay, enough, we're done.
Mm-hmm.
But as I looked back and was working on it, I was like, holy crap, I guess I have done a little bit in my short lifetime.
Mm. I'd argue a lot of it.
Mm-hmm. But and then there were things that, you know, I didn't mention in the short bio that are important, like establishing the Kenai River Center. Mm-hmm. You know, when Don Gilman hired me planning director, he said, two things I want you to focus on, oil and gas and getting the Kenai River Center established and up and running. And that's something we were able to get done. Mm-hmm. And that center that it sits out by Saldaña Airport today is something I can say that I was at the beginning of, because Don Gilman said, go get it done. And I said, yes, sir. And we did. And working in collaboration with the state agencies, you know, we were able to get the state agencies to say, yeah, we'll be part of it. Mm-hmm. And it's grown over the years to include additional agencies. Mm-hmm. One-stop shopping makes life easier for the people that need to get permits and approvals.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that? Feels like such a good concrete example of, you know, something you were a part of. Is there anything that you haven't gotten to yet that you are would still like to do or see done?
Oh, there are things that I'd still like to see done, and there's things that I'm working on and have, you know, in the back, but we'll see how it all comes together.
All right. You're keeping those cards close to your chest.
Yeah, because, you know, until you get things kind of worked out, you don't want to spill it, and then everybody's going to be like, well, I thought you were going to be doing that, and then it's like it didn't come to fruition.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, I'll throw it to you just for a, you know, final thoughts, wrap up. If there's anything you would hoped to talk about or wanted to talk about, the floor is yours.
You know, I couldn't have done this over the years without the support of my husband. Mm-hmm. And as the listeners know, he's a phenomenal guy. He's got great taste in music and obviously great taste in women.
Yeah. Shout out to Steve.
Yeah. Shout out to my great husband, Steve Horn.
That'll be all for this week's episode of the Kenai Conversation. Thank you so much again to Lisa Parker for joining us. And as a reminder, you can hear the Kenai Conversation every Wednesday at 10 a.m. and Saturday at 5 p.m. here on KDLL. You can also find the show on our website at kdll.org. I'm Ashlyn O'Hara. Thank you for listening.